I would like to start by opening to whatever people have relative to the topics that we discussed last time. Any questions or comments or ahas about power and structural power and personal power that anybody would like to explore? Now would be a good time.
I found that such a helpful reminder in a really wonderful way. I am a clinical social worker doing counseling. And right from the beginning, you're always told, look at the strengths. And sometimes after working with people, you tend, especially when you're working with groups of people who are so living in situations that are so unfair, I tend to forget that, or I had been forgetting it. And just listing all those strengths that you had, the resources, and writing down a list for me, what I have, and a list for them, what they have, was so helpful. It just illuminated so many things that they had, but we hadn't been tapping into, and resources that I had that I could share. So it was excellent. I just love it as a tool that I can use with each person, and it's not just my clients, it's with friends as well. Thank you.
You're welcome. I am really appreciating this reminder that when we really deeply look at what power means, then we can discover in a very concrete way that all of us can have power instead of in some kind of abstract and superficial way that equalizes everything. Which I hear sometimes in the language that is used in certain places, you know, where there's a way to recover our power that doesn't lose sight of the social context of power differences. That capacity to do that is very dear to me. Because it's almost like there's a dichotomy. There are people who focus a lot on structural power, and there is kind of like a tone of powerlessness that comes right from those analyses, like certain people just can't have power and that's just it. And then there are the people who are focused on individual power, and it's almost like they tend to ignore the fact that things don't exist in a social vacuum.
Yeah.
So having both of these, and something in what you said kind of like highlighted for me, that if we break it down into the specific resources, then, for example, one of the sources of power that certain people have is access to community, because it is often the case that lower income, lower external resources communities have more social ties and can call on each other in ways that affluent people have lost. If you start having these really nuanced analyses, it really brings light to all these complexities. So thank you for pinpointing that. Anything else?
There's one little part to it, and that was recognizing that they had access to information. Like they have the right to information that I hadn't really thought of as a resource, but it would be huge as a resource.
What is?
It was legal information, actually. It was actually looking at their own record in terms of why the courts were thinking that they should lose their son.
Yeah.
And so it really being allowed to, or not just allowed, but having the right to look at the details of that. I haven't seen the details. I've been trying to help them for months, but I haven't seen the details. I've just been told about them. And I was thinking, hey, we all have the right to look at this.
Yeah, got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else relevant to power that anybody wants to bring up?
This has been a very painful week for me, and I'm really grateful for it. It's a lot of throwing up in the air all the balls and not sure where they're going to land. And there was something about the internal resources and the external resources that each of us have, and if we have our external resources well supported, we have more chance of having our internal resources more supported. Mm. And I've been walking around with the word entitlement in my head. it's been painful to look and to look back on my past and look at the times when I really kind of snapped and took and didn't consider who was in the room. At the same time, I don't know, it's just been meandering uncomfortably around this topic, and I'm really grateful for it, the structure and the support to do this and the questions that you've asked. I don't know why I'm kind of sharing that. It's just I'm sharing my discomfort and my aha and my gratitude, really.
I'm really grateful to you, and I want to ask you a follow-up question, because part of my big dream is to be able to raise these questions, not without discomfort, without shame. Because Inbal and I worked really hard to create the materials in such a way that there's no wrongness in what is said. And so I want to know, in this discomfort, have you felt shame?
I definitely have visited shame. And I have to say, that's what I love. So you've named what I've been trying to name about your materials. The shame, I'm really aware, doesn't come from your questions. I have to say that. It's more my meandering. And it's actually your questions that pull me back from that or allow me to see another way to be with this, particularly the self-acceptance piece, which I have to confess I've shared with a few people. I've just loved it. So, yeah, the blog that you wrote.
Thank you. I'm really satisfied, and I'm wishing you tenderness and support on this journey and to keep going with it, because my experience has been that shedding attachment to comfortable untruths and opening to uncomfortable truths and engaging with them in the end creates more freedom. So ponder that.
I'm encouraged by that, Nikki. Thank you.
I wanted to celebrate something that happened this week, and basically it is related to power in the sense that I actually risked its significance and completely decided that of course I have something to say in a structure that was used to having a board and a director, and usually people just shut up. They don't say a thing. They don't ever risk to say what they really think. And with all the material we've been working on, and especially this week, I decided to just say in my heart. And it was very uncomfortable. I faced a lot of discomfort from others and people trying to protect themselves. Defensiveness. I was surprised to see how I just kept on believing that we could hold everybody's needs, and I made it clear. And it didn't take much time, but it was extremely uncomfortable for everybody. But when people realized I'm not fighting, I'm working with them, and I made that clear, we went into another dimension, and I think everybody was shocked. So I'm really celebrating that, and I really want to express my gratitude, the material, the thinking that it brought, you know, the journey that it opened me. So thank you very much.
I'm really glad, especially because I have this belief that there is a veil of discomfort that has to do with kind of like the ease of going along with accepted norms. And that it takes a lot of upfront willingness to walk through that. And when you walk through that and invite other people to walk through it with you, there is a different dimension of much simpler, clearer, more authentic, more connected way of relating that people can find even if they have never been trained. So I'm appreciating the reminder. Thank you.
I'm really excited about the word choice. It's the most empowering word I think I've heard in a long time. And what I love about it is that both internally and externally, when we exercise that power, we don't have to buy in to even what our own minds are telling us or what society's telling us. But it's so freeing just to know that I can choose not to believe what's been told me before, or I can choose to opt out of something that is kind of a given that we do on a social level, and it's just so liberating.
Thank you. I want to take this opportunity to check in, because I honestly am not remembering in the moment whether I included in any of the materials the distinction between choice and options.
I don't remember that, but maybe somebody else does.
If I didn't, or if it's not ringing a bell, I would like to either repeat it or say it firstly, which is that when people have power, structural power, they can limit our options. Nobody can take away choice. That, to me, is one of the most liberating distinctions and clarities that I've ever had. And so I really want us to train our minds to recognize the difference between saying, I don't have a choice, which is really in some ways never true, and saying, given the options available to me, I prefer this even though I don't like it, which is a very, very different internal orientation that makes life much more alive, much more ours, much more real. I wanted to highlight this. It kind of like relates to the excitement that you expressed about choice.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm going to contemplate it more.
Thank you. Okay. So now I want to move to the material that lots of it that I shared with you, it almost felt cruel, like trying to pack again, but even more so, an entire class of many sessions into one session. So by necessity, this would be kind of like an appetizer buffet rather than a sit-down dinner. I don't know why I came up with this particular metaphor. So I think that what I would like to do is very briefly hear from people what aspect of the materials you would like us to focus on for today, because I don't see that we can focus on all of it. So I'd like anyone that has a particular wish for a particular focus to press one, even if it's all of you. This will give me a sense of how to structure our time for today to maximize what you feel passionate about. So does anybody have specific wishes about where to focus?
Education and socialization.
Education and socialization, and specifically?
I'm just looking specifically at the institution of schools.
Got it. Anyone else?
I'm curious if you might elaborate a little bit about your own exploration of the theories of human nature part.
Great. Thank you.
I like the section about collaborative societies.
Okay, thank you.
I'm very much interested in the, it's related to education, what we can do to help children envision a world of nonviolence and a world that is far from dualities.
Got it. Okay. I have enough to get started. What I am kind of like drawn to start with is a very kind of like heart-achy realization that I had a few years ago. The realization that I had is that in most dimensions of power difference in our society, there is a lip service given to the idea of equality. It doesn't actually pan out in reality. And still, there is at least the language that talks about equality. So, for example, we have a language that talks about there being equality between the sexes, and there's that now that's the official policy, no discrimination based on sex or gender. There is a language of equality between races and ethnicities, you know, the Civil Rights Act and all of these things. And with one group, there isn't even a pretense of equality, and that is children. There is nowhere that I hear people proclaiming creating equal relationships between adults and children. It's not even considered a value to aspire to. And that was really shocking for me when I realized this, that this is kind of like a blind spot frontier. Even people who are passionate about social justice, democracy, racial justice, you name it, are still completely willing to accept as given the idea of adults making decisions for children and controlling their lives. So I want to pause just to see if anybody has any difficulty understanding what I'm pointing to. Because I think to me it sounds like it's very easy to discern. I just am curious if there's anyone who sees it differently. Not in the sense of, if you disagree about giving equality to children, I don't have an issue with that. I'm happy to engage with that in a moment. I just want to know if you in any way, anywhere, see that there's a commitment, an explicit commitment to equality with children, then I'd like to hear from you. I'm happy to hear anything from you. I first want to know if anybody has that picture somewhere that you've seen that.
I think you're right across the board in a lot of ways, but I didn't raise my son that way, and I know of others who collaborate with their kids. I don't think it's common. I don't think it's pervasive in any way, but very rewarding to do it.
So let me ask you, did you ever punish your children?
You know, his actions punished him when he got in trouble once in high school. You know, I thought about getting angry at him, and I knew he was suffering so much from what he had done that I never even raised my voice. And he learned and he grew so much from that, but I don't see the point in lording it over.
I am delighted for him that he had that experience. And I think the final proof is in the pudding of, was that also his experience or only yours?
I don't know that. I know that the best advice I had as a parent, shower them with love when they're young. Don't deny anything, and they become extremely powerful adults. And I've seen that with my son. I think there are more people than you think, but I don't know how many.
Thank you. Yeah.
So, Nikki, the closest I come to this being true is looking through Dominic Barta's lens and restorative circle work, where we're all sitting equal in the circle, and also I see this as a striving of Catherine Cadden's work as well.
Yes. Of course, there are individuals like some of us who are trying to promote this. As a common social value, it doesn't exist in my eyes. And if you compare it to, let's say, gender equality, there is, you know, widespread commitment to the idea. Even though it's not done in practice, the idea has become socially accepted. And that's where I see the difference. It's not how strongly is it practiced, how strongly is it even advocated for in the culture at large.
I see the distinction.
Thank you. Yes. I know that there are many projects where there are attempts to create equality with children. I don't have any doubt about it. I just think it's a very radical frontier. It's like the last stronghold of where domination is socially accepted. That was the point that I was trying to make. Thank you. And Dana?
I think the whole assumption about children is wrong. And that's part of the problem, is that we assume that because they're little, they don't have all the qualities and feelings and thoughts that we do.
Yeah. That was going to be my next point, which is if you listen to the language that speaks about why children don't have rights, for example, to vote, or why they're not equipped to make decisions for themselves, you can see that same language in the past was used to say why, you know, people of color can't vote, why women can't vote, why, you know, one or the other group cannot be entrusted with, you know, responsibility, etc. Everything that is said about children has also been said about other groups. So that part also amazes me, the way that that learning hasn't yet happened. So that was one thing that I wanted to say in terms of that whole question of education and socialization, which is that changing the way that education and socialization happens is an extraordinarily radical act. And part of why it's radical is because it's so rare. And another part of why it's radical is because in some ways, if we don't change how children are treated, whatever gains we make will only live one generation, and all the horrors can be recreated in another generation. If we imprint the next generation with any sense that one person ruling over another is okay, then we haven't really transformed the social structures in the deepest possible way. That is one piece that I wanted to say about this whole project. And I think I want to loop back to Todd and see if what we've been talking so far is speaking to what you were hoping I would address.
Yeah, it does actually help me or encourage me to really advocate for children and really shifting the schools that I'm in. I like your vision in terms of bringing this relationship to the next generation so that it doesn't stop.
Yeah. I think that a lot of very powerful work was done by my sister, who really developed the whole scope of NVC and parenting. And then there is also work done by people who are looking at the education arena. And something about treating children as equal. What equality means to me is simply recognizing the same needs. So, for example, I once did a training in a school for teachers, and I asked them to tell me what needs they thought that the students were bringing with them to school that they, the teachers, wanted to support the children in meeting. Very tame question. And they named any number of needs, all of which I could relate to. They didn't name one need, which is the very one that Dana was talking about before, which is choice and autonomy. It was not on their radar screen that that is a need that the students would have. So that is how blinded so many adults are, because of not thinking that children are essentially the same kind of human being as adults are. Anything else for now, Todd?
I'm actually kind of pausing on this choice piece because I know that there's an urge within me to also streamline it and okay, let's involve them up front and have them choose and then go with it, or something along the line of like limiting the choices, getting to a specific direction.
So you also recognize in yourself a desire to limit the choice of children.
I noticed that within myself, sure, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for acknowledging that, because I think it is part of the legacy that we have received. I have been both blessed and cursed to have vivid memories of what things felt like when I was a child. All I ask you to do in any of those contexts is to imagine yourself being one of the children whose range of options you want to limit. And imagine what that feels like and what long-term effect that would have on you. What happens when you do that?
Well, part of me is in my head imagining what could be long-term consequences.
Let me ask you this pointed long-term consequence. How free would you become as an adult person?
Part of me is like almost hoping for like the expression of humanity to come through and not be thwarted, and to know that I encouraged that dialogue, or at least try to bring it out.
Yeah.
So it's not like there's any instance where I'm completely like shutting off places. It's just that these are the directions that I see and kind of put forth. And then there's ramifications and we go into dialogue, you know, figure out the consequences in many different factors.
For me, the key is, does the child truly participate in the decision? Is it truly a collaboration? It doesn't matter to me where it starts. So let me illustrate this with a little story from my nephew, who was raised in the most non-coercive, non-punitive, non-rewarding, collaborative household that I can imagine. And one day I came to visit. This was when he was about, I think, 4 or 5, that young. I came to visit and my sister was talking very excitedly about having created a new order or something in his room. And I intuitively had a sense that, you know, this is not something that I intuitively would assume that a young boy would be interested in. So I asked him, was it your idea or was it your mother's idea? And he looked at me like, what a weird question I was asking. And his answer was simple. He said, we decide together. And in that moment, I knew he lives in heaven. Because it wouldn't happen if he wasn't really okay with it. So whatever happens in that household involves everybody's conscious, explicit moving towards and with each other to create things that work for everyone. That's what I'm talking about. So your having ideas up front doesn't worry me. It's the question of whether there is any subtle pressure on the children to agree with your ideas.
Yeah, so like specifically, I'm in the process of writing this attendance policy for our cross-country team and the consequences that are in there because I'm getting pressure from my assistants as well as my administrators about making sure that like I'm not taking too much time in talking with these kids and that I'm making really like lasting decisions and making it happen. And so I almost feel coerced into making a punitive type system.
This is where the embeddedness within a larger structure pops up. And so here is what I would imagine you could do within the structure. You could go to the children and say, I have been told to create an attendance policy, and I want your input. What do you imagine would be an attendance policy that would be supportive of you and the larger system and the larger goals of learning? And see what happens.
What if I say, here's my proposal. Would you guys give input on how you want to see it happen?
Because of your position of relative power, they are more likely to say yes to what you propose than no, whether they agree with it or not. That's just how power differences work. So it would be different if you said, here's my proposal. Tell me what are the holes in it. What am I not seeing? Where do you see that you could improve it that is more generative? You see what I mean?
Yeah.
If we are in position of power and we want to shift it, what that means is to invite the no.
What are the holes?
Yeah.
What are we not picking up?
Yeah.
Okay.
In what way would this be onerous for you? Do you have better suggestions? What am I not seeing? After all, I'm not going to have to live with the consequences of this policy. You are, so tell me how to change it to make it work for you.
I'm just imagining, I'm going to want to sleep in and not show up to practice. Well, is that going to achieve the goals that you're out here for?
That's what I mean about not trusting children.
Yeah.
If the policy is coercive, they're going to be less engaged. They're going to want to sleep in. If they get any whiff that they can take ownership of what is happening, it's going to get them more interested. Do you want them to show up because they are afraid of consequences? Or do you want them to show up because they see that this will contribute to them? The more coercive, the more you will get the former rather than the latter. It will be harder for them to find intrinsic value. So I want to stop
this
because...
I'm fine with this. We can go on.
This could fill up hours. Thank you.
When you first brought up the idea, Mickey, what came to me is I was just wondering, you mentioned an instance when you said that you had a conversation with a Waldorf teacher and you weren't able to find common ground, and you're wishing you could at this point. And I know this is just kind of a fundamental point in Waldorf education, is that you don't give children choice, that it's a part of their development, and that it actually creates a lot of stress if they're given choice at too young of an age.
So I am well aware of it, that difference exists, and so I want to know what you would like about it in this moment.
Well, I'm just trying to really to understand what you're saying about giving children choice.
I want to say that in the way that I see it, the choice is there already. We don't give or take away choice. What we do is we give or take away options, and we deliver consequences for certain choices. We cannot take away choice from children. It's physiologically impossible unless we tie them up. And even then, internally, they still have choice. I know this because I know that internally as a child, I was free to think whatever I wanted to think. Nobody could take that away from me, and I knew that. So I want to be really clear and honest with the language. What you take away from children is options, which means that in order to exercise choice, they have to be more internally resilient, both in terms of having access to imagining options that are not given to them, and having more courage to be willing to face consequences. But the choice is always there. Does that make sense to you?
Well, perhaps it is that distinction that I'm looking for. So when you're offering a child, you want cereal or eggs or toast for breakfast, those are options.
Yes.
When really the choice is, do you want to eat or not?
No. The choice is that whatever you offer, the child is going to do what they're going to do. Here is the thing. If you give the child, here is breakfast, and the child has total choice about whether they're going to eat it or not. It is very, very difficult to force a child to eat, literally force them to eat. That's what I mean by they have choice. Now, if you say toast, eggs, or cereal, they have more options. They don't have more or less choice. In a Waldorf setting where you say, now we're going to do this, because I know that that's, you know, that there's something about creating rhythm and everything moves together, the child still has choice to not do it. It takes incredible strength to recognize that that choice exists, but it is there. When somebody holds a gun to your head, you still have choice. The consequences can be grave. The choice is never gone. I thank you for bringing this up. And this is, I know we're talking about children, and all of it applies in every area of life. When, you know, let's say you're going and doing a demonstration, and the police come and tell you to disperse, they're not taking away your choice. You still have the choice about whether you're going to disperse or not, knowing that choosing not to disperse may mean you're going to be arrested. You can't prevent your arrest, but that doesn't mean you don't have choice. Does this help?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
And there are different philosophies about to what degree you want to enlighten the child about the fact that they have choice.
And the other one is the First Nations culture. They don't really believe in telling anybody what to do. And, you know, so I think it really is in their culture in a different way.
Thank you for that. I am delighted to hear this.
Thank you.
Thanks. I am seeing that there is a lot that comes up around this, and still, like I said, this is going to be an appetizer, and I think we already had a very full dinner plate on this particular topic. I just want to address for a moment the question of what can we do to help children envision a world of nonviolence? Part of the dilemma of creating change is that by the time children are pretty young, 4, 5, 6, they already have completely imbued the punitive picture of the world. I would say that the best thing you can do to help children envision a world of nonviolence is live it with them. The more you do it, the more they will see it as possible. This is all I want to say about that piece, and now I want to move to the other question that people wanted me to focus on, which is the question of human nature. And the way I would frame it is, how are theories of human nature shape the kind of society that we create, or are in turn shaped by the society that we live in? And I want to start from the latter part. I want to illustrate it with an example, with a few examples. For example, this is not exactly about human nature. It's an example that is so powerful that I want to use it, if you can allow me a tiny bit of semi-digression, which is, I think you all know that ideals of beauty have changed over the years in Western civilization. What is considered a beautiful woman in particular? Up until 200 or 300 years ago, the ideal of beauty was plump and very pale skin. And today, the ideal of beauty is kind of tanned and much thinner. And if you try to imagine what created this change, you come up against an amazing piece of historical and social change, which is that at the time when the ideal of beauty was plump and pale, it was a time when the upper classes were indoors and people who were working were mostly working outdoors. Upper class people had enough food to eat, and the other people didn't have enough food to eat. So the people who worked outdoors were tanned and thin. And so being tanned and thin would color you as a lower class person. And therefore the ideal of beauty matched what the privilege of the upper classes allowed them to access. Nowadays it's the reverse. The upper classes have leisure, so where they can go sit on the beach, enjoy themselves, go to sunny places, eat healthy food that keeps you lean. And the people who are working are mostly working indoors, in factories, in offices, and they don't get exposure to the sun. So it flipped. And the message is the same message. It's a social message of, I have privilege. Not that we know this or that we do it consciously. It's embedded culturally. That is the kind of detective work that I'm talking about in terms of seeing how changes in society affect how we think about people. Here's another example that is much more related to the question of human nature in particular, and that is that we now tend to think in much more individualized and psychological ways about people. That in itself, that way of looking at people, parallels the way that individuals became separated from larger communities and extended families in which they were embedded. And so the individual as a unit emerged from the way society is structured and now is affecting how we think about people. So these are just a couple of the examples, and there could be more. This is totally not anything that is specifically NVC. It's completely analytical. It's just to illustrate this whole point. That's one piece. Then more subtle things are that with the creation of competitive structures, we have created people who are competing and much more separate from each other. And our theories about people have come to reflect that reality. We think of people as greedy, competitive, selfish, maximizing their own benefit, because this is what the way we live has generated. That's about all I want to say about this direction of influence, unless there's any question or comment that anybody wants to add at this point.
I would like to go back, because it's the same place I got struck last week, which was the individualized. I'd just like to understand this a little better. Something about we've pulled away from our family structures, our family communities. When you look at a lot of tribal cultures, there's very much a co-parenting going on, a co-community. The family's so much bigger. That's my experience, a big generalization. Is it kind of changing from that to our much more nuclear, smaller families separated from each other physically with fences and buildings and bricks and walls? Is that what you mean?
That is part of what I mean. That did happen in the last, decades and couple of centuries.
And are you saying that has now influenced the way we think and the way we care for our own individual needs?
It's not that we think smaller. It's that we think of ourselves as more separate than we used to think of ourselves as.
As more separate and so less interdependent, so more independent. And
yes. Okay. So if you want to recast it back into the language of needs, one of the needs that becomes all-consuming is the need for autonomy. And autonomy gets translated into what products I buy. And no one tells me what to do.
So it's focused on options rather than real choices.
Yes.
I do have a question, because I kind of got stuck on this looking at my own life and looking at how autonomy has probably been the biggest need that I've chosen from. How to work with re-engaging interdependence, or have you got anything to say about how do we then move more towards, like, say if I come up with my choice coming from a strong need for autonomy, how do I move from this picture of just really autonomy being a need I'll fight for? Is it about just including other needs?
I think that the way I see it is several pieces. One is waking up to more needs. One is redefining what autonomy means and shifting it to its original meaning, which is literally means making my own rules. It doesn't mean doing what I feel like. So really becoming curious and learning about the nature of choice and what really gives us an experience of having made a choice, which is really what ultimately autonomy is about. It's these two pieces, waking up to more needs and shifting what autonomy means to us, that I think is the path towards more organic interdependence.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh, thank you.
You mentioned something in the document somewhere about enemy imagery, and I'm aware of in a society that stresses competitiveness and autonomy, and that there's certain theories of human nature that are atomizing or alienating. Like, we've built this structure that's kind of torn away the web of interdependence.
Yes.
I feel like I haven't really understood enemy imagery as deeply as I'd like, and I just was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about this whole thing.
The enemy image and how it fits into this whole thing?
Yeah.
Let me think and see if I see a connection, and I'm also inviting anyone else to step in if you have a way of responding.
Like one quick little thing is what you talked about with the pan and the leisure class versus the working class. Like, that's kind of a subtle form of enemy imagery.
Where do you see enemy imagery?
People kind of wanting to have an external imagery that posits themselves as one of the upper class.
So whose enemy image would it be?
My guess is it's an advertising thing. I mean, advertising wasn't around in the earlier centuries, but just that it's a part of the economic system, in a way, of incentives and that kind of
thing. Okay, so for me, an enemy image, you know, what's useful to me about enemy images is recognizing their power inside of me and working with them on that level. The images that are created by, you know, whatever agency creates them are not powerful unless I let them be. So the unit of work is my own enemy images of other people or of other institutions. I can have enemy images about the advertising industry, that they are damaging the world. That's an enemy image.
Where I get stuck with enemy imagery is I see the value in the jackal thinking at times, that there's something about it that's really advocating for something that I'm valuing.
Yes. Jackal thinking is a strategy, and as such, it is always an attempt to meet needs. Everything is an attempt to meet needs, and nothing is outside of that. So there isn't any throwaway thoughts, any throwaway actions. There's just a question about to what degree can I become conscious and embrace the needs rather than just be embedded in the action.
It's really a shift of consciousness and bringing your attention or awareness to the need over and over again, more deeply, rather than being stuck in the habituated.
Yeah. It's to whatever degree we can make conscious choices about which needs we are prioritizing and how we're going to go about life, without making anything bad or wrong, that's when the internal shift starts creating spirals that grow within us and then outside us, and we start affecting other people.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So the people who were asking me to comment about human nature, I'm no longer tracking who it was, so I want to close the loop and see if I addressed your topic sufficiently, or do you want anything else to be highlighted?
I'm totally satisfied.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to let you know, I was the other one.
Okay. Did you get enough?
Yeah, I did. I just one quick thing. You know how there's like a distinction between having an intention to connect versus being right?
Yes.
That's kind of around what you were talking about with enemy imagery, that when you're coming from that place of having a genuine intention to connect or curiosity.
Yes. Yes, I can tell you that when I can get over my reaction to certain things that people do, there is in me an unbelievable curiosity about how someone could do things that are so foreign to me. I really, really, really want to understand it because I know that they're human like me. I know it. I just can't sometimes solve the puzzle on my own. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's why you were just talking about cultivating curiosity being so key.
Yeah. Yeah, so if I could, for example, there is someone in my life, an ongoing person in my life, who almost never says yes when I ask them to do something for me. Almost never. And I have never been able to get, except in moments, to a place of enough relaxation about the shock to be able to be genuinely curious. And I am quite confident that if I had the internal capacity to approach this person and say, I am really curious. So much of the time when I ask you to do something for me, you say no. And it's so different from the way that I operate in the world. I just really want to understand what it's like to have this experience of an automatic no. I'm just dying to understand. I probably would learn something very useful. I just can't pull it off. I'll go further. Let's say that someone is a serial murderer. I do have curiosity to understand what exactly happens. And that curiosity is motivated by my desire to find ways to create more safety. If I really understood what goes on for a serial murderer, really got it, I probably could do something to meet this person's needs better. Thank you for highlighting the piece about curiosity. So I am now curious, what other aspect, what are people thinking of in terms of the materials? The piece that I have a lot of juice for is really engaging maybe in a bit of conversation about that question of the distinction between personal growth and social change and the difference between having many people change themselves, the difference between cumulative individual change and actual social change. And I'd like to know if anyone has a sense that you understood something for yourself about that distinction that you can articulate in words and get us started in this piece of the conversation. Do you personally believe that cumulative personal change can transform the social structures within which we live? If so, I would love for you to engage with me and tell me why you think that. Either way, I'm longing for company in holding this paradox, this question.
I will say that for me, I think you're so right that we're all interdependent. And I guess if one person changes and they share it, it can be a catalyst for others to change. But I think we're so interconnected that it's in the interactions where the social change comes. So many people have started it. I just think it's a matter of time before the critical mass is reached, because I do think it's happening, especially with NVC reaching out around the world. I just think the more we interact with others, the more they catch on. And I mean, I've seen light bulbs go on with my sophomoric attempts at NVC in groups, you know, and even that makes people happy. Just think it's a matter of hanging in there. I guess cumulative personal change I just see as all interdependent.
The way that I'm understanding what you're saying is that you have a very deep passion and belief in the idea that if a critical mass of individuals changes, then something fundamental will change in the way the world is run.
That's correct, and I also see that it's happening.
What do you see it's happening, that we're closer to the critical mass?
Well, I just think there's so much upheaval and there's so much awakening happening with people about the power of choice and about...
The question that I have is, do you see, as a result of all these individual changes, do you see a change in the way things like corporations are operating?
I was listening to the radio today and thinking, you know, do we circumvent these institutions and just go on, which to me seems like a really viable option at this point, because they're on a track. I almost feel like we have to just have to step outside that structure and create ours, and eventually it'll overrun there. That's my hope.
Okay.
Where I trust in the intention that there's a shift in the intention to contribute to life, I have trouble trusting that I'm seeing more of a, what I would label as greenwashing. But I do see more people that are involved, actively involved in nonprofit work. There's a movement towards being more effective and use more business and social enterprise models to accomplish the work that is really important to do. I see that shift away from this scarcity being based on almost a begging for money type attitude to, we can do this differently, we can be financially sustainable and accomplish our social change
Mm-hmm. So what I'm getting from what you and Dana have said in different ways is two things. One is that there is a lot of change in many individuals, and that I heard that from Dana, a lot of faith in the power of that. What I'm hearing from you in addition is that you see groupings of people starting to do things differently, like creating a new kind of nonprofit or creating socially conscious businesses or things like this that you see as part of moving towards the future. Maybe that's kind of like part of the structure that Dana was talking about, let's create our own structures. Does that resonate for you?
Yeah, I think I see that, some creation of alternative structures.
Yeah.
And also using what works within the systems that aren't set up right now that are serving life, and to use what is working, like their marketing tools, to put those towards efforts to create social change.
Thank you. So before going on to the next person, I want to throw in one more kind of like challenge to think about as you are holding all these questions, which is, there is a phenomenon that is now documented by a number of people that even individuals who have evolved their own inner consciousness and even their interpersonal skills, when they come together and form an organization, it doesn't necessarily scale up from the individual to the organization. The organizations still tend to function in a similar old paradigm way. I get from it that there is some other, at least some other set of skills or some other consciousness if we want to create different structures. And the last thing that I want to say also about what you said, there's a difference for me between, you know, you say there's greenwashing, whether there's this or that change in product, this or that engagement in doing some social contribution, difference between all of that and the fundamental logic of how an organization or corporation or government operates, which has to do with how resources are allocated, how decisions are made, what is the vision, what is the mission. So in that sense, whether it's genuine or not, in my perception, unless the structures of how we do business change, we're not really transforming the fundamental way of operating in the world. So I want to hear from Carolyn and Mitsiko.
Hi, Nikki. I'm responding to what you were just saying, and also there was another thought following up with what people were saying in terms of grassroots attempts and people working together, and not just attempts, but really actually creating things. I love the image. I know it's from my own faith background, but it's probably from others too, the idea of rivulets, little tiny drops, little tiny streams all coming and eventually wearing down the rock, right? Creating a new force. But then when you were talking about how individuals, even if they're doing their best to change themselves and to grow, coming together and winding up in a paradigm that's almost identical to the old one. I do think that just as we need education ourselves individually, whether it's through MVC or through other paths as well, that groups need education, like how to consult in a new way and really to have it consultative rather than. I totally see how well-meaning individuals can come together and without education wind up lapsing into Rogers rules or whatever it was.
Yes.
You know,
So it's essential to have at least well laid out models, structures, processes for doing things differently that people can tap into. Because unless you have something new that you know to do as an individual or as a group, you will do what you always knew.
Right, right.
Yeah. Thank you. Did you want to add anything?
It was just an example. The thing that came to mind was going to Israel and being with Baha'is who were models for me. It was just sort of the upside down of everything. It was those who are really making a lot of decisions who are the most humble, you know, the least in your face. So just seeing that model, as you, what you said about having new ways modeled for us can be really the best. Don't just talk about it, but do it. Actions, not words.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. So next.
I also shared the vision that I need to do my own thing. And what I realized recently is that I also want to get into the power models that we have right now. I can't just do my thing in my little corner, and sometimes the thing I meet with nonprofit organizations, we can't create that bridge to others. We sort of stay in our little world and get angry that society doesn't see it the way we do. So I'm really into the vision that I'm going to go in the world and risk my significance. Every single time I did do it, it had an impact.
Any person, you know, such as Gandhi or Martin Luther King, they didn't start out being a leader with millions of followers. They started out as a small child who grew up and became an adult and had a dream and decided to go for it. One of us could be the next Gandhi. We never know. Thank you.
Well, this is a question that I've carried for years, and I don't have an answer for it. But what I had as I'm listening to the conversation is just a wondering if, when you say that you have this experience or phenomena where there's a group of people that have been working with spiritual principles, high ideals, are evolved, and still, when they're working organizationally, things fall into the same sort of mush, and they don't seem to work. It's almost as if it's an opportunity for each of us to peel away another layer of our personal development, and that somehow maybe that's what's missing, and that's why organizationally it's still not working for us.
I'm really wondering about that, because it keeps putting the focus on the individual. And to me, that is what we do in our time, is focus on the individual. And I also know the reverse, that if you create structures that are designed to be inclusive, then individuals who haven't necessarily done a whole lot of spiritual development participate in better ways. And that has also been seen. I tend to think of it as a separate, independent, interdependent, but still independent level that needs attention separate from the attention on individuals. That is really the thing that I look at and see. So keep pondering it. Don't agree with me just because I said it. I just want everyone to keep pondering these questions. Thank you. And with that, I just would like to do a go-round and hear each person's voice. If you can say about what stands out to you from this entire class. How has this class enriched you? What did you get? What was fun? Anything like this, so that we have a little closing circle. Whoever wants to go first?
I think for me, I just see that it's really about a journey into the heart, out of the head. And that's the way I see we all need to go, and especially in my own life, to not listen to my own thoughts so much, but to really anchor in my heart. And that's what I love so much about NDC.
Thank you. And for me, I feel really sad about this group ending, because I have felt so free to really delve into the ideas and the complexity in a way that I often don't believe people will enjoy. Just because you all signed up for it and we went for it, I am just so thrilled and so grateful to all of you for being on this journey. Thank you.
This is the course I needed at the right moment in my life, going from I'm socially active in my community and I don't know what to do to, hey, I have all the tools I need to do my thing.
Thank you.
word that came up for me when you first asked the question about how has this enriched you was hope. Dialing in weekly, it's really just given me a focus and a hope for myself and for just us on this planet. So
thank you. Couldn't hope for more.
This class, along with a lot of the other materials that you're making available, like the YouTube conflict hotline, is just making these principles much faster in my integration, and this aided really crystallizing like the assumptions and principles that are guiding this practice.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I guess I'll just say the resources from last week and the curiosity from this week just hit the spot with a breakdown in communication I've had with a cousin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mickey, I always love hearing you talk about theory and delving into that, and partially because I can hear how much you enjoy it. It feels like the word that comes up for me isn't a pretty one, but it's fertilizer. I feel like I've been fertilized.
Thank you.
I like that fertilizer. What's come to me is compost. I'm literally breaking down and building up and breaking down, and there's a part of me that's going to miss this rhythm and this weekly thing, and there's a part of me a bit relieved because it's been quite intense to have such great materials calling me constantly. I'm grateful for this. It feels like quite a deep dip in the river. Gratitude for your passion and that you chose to offer this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm a little lost to sort of encapsulate the whole course. I'm still kind of processing some things. Probably just bringing up more questions for me, but important questions that I want to think some more about, and things like how do I get to a place of really experiencing more choice in my life. Also, really like the question about equality between adults and children, and it's an area that I am deeply concerned about just because of my own experience with that, and kind of scared at the same time about addressing it in our world, and that
Thank
I'm
you.
Seeing opportunities for doing that. So I guess considering things that I want to learn about and also where I want to put my focus in terms of social change.
Thank you.
You gave an option to connect with our own beliefs and our own what really matters to us. And I can't remember being able to feel as comfortable with doing that, and to have it so, that option being so, it was a real gift to me, and I really thank you.
Thank you.
It was just uncanny how every single class, like today, it was so appropriate to what was going on in my life. I've been dealing with a landlord the last 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and today my husband and I were talking about our daughter,
mm-hmm.
and I was to communicate something to him, and your words were just so powerful in how to reframe what I was trying to say. So it's always just so spot on with life and the moment, so thank you.
Great. So two very quick things that I wanted to say. One is that the passion that I have is for theory that is connected to the heart. That's where I get excited. Theory that is just disembodied ideas doesn't do it for me. And I have a sense that I've been able to do that and got this feedback, and that's very gratifying for me. And the other thing I wanted to say is one ongoing way to stay in community with me and other people who are really committed to transforming their consciousness is to join the Consciousness Transformation Community, which I created, which you can also find information about on the BNVC website. So until our paths cross again, thank you all for being here and making my journey lighter for a few weeks. Bye-bye.